From the Melanie Nedzukaman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona, this is Keeping Up with Public Health Pandemic Response. This episode, we speak with Dr. Keith Joyner and Dr. Joe Gerald. Keith Joyner is a professor of medicine, economics, and health promotion science at the University of Arizona. He is co-director of the Center for Management Innovations in Healthcare and served as the dean of the University of Arizona's College of Medicine from 2004 to 2008. His research focuses on the optimization of resource allocation in academic health centers, the relationship between medical decision-making and emergency departments, and the subsequent cost and outcome. Joe Gerald is an associate professor of public health policy and management. He teaches courses covering healthcare in the U.S., health economics and policy, and interpreting public health literature. His research is focused on the cost-effectiveness of respiratory-related infections, including tuberculosis contact screening and school-based asthma management.
So thank you, Dr. Joyner and Dr. Gerald, for joining us today here on the podcast. To begin, Dr. Joyner, can you give us a brief understanding of the zoonotic timeline of SARS-CoV-2 and how we know the virus jumped from animals to humans?
Sure. Let me broaden that out even more so and point out what I think probably most of the listeners are aware of is that the large majority of emerging infectious diseases that we've seen over many decades are zoonoses. In other words, they're infections that are coming from an animal source. HIV is probably the most dramatic example, but I could list many others besides SARS and MERS, the other coronaviruses, Ebola, West Nile, avian influenza. So it's important to remember or be reminded that this is a typical biological phenomenon. In this case, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, as well as SARS and MERS, which are the other two coronaviruses that cause severe disease, their primary reservoir was in bats, where it doesn't cause any illness. And then they've gone through intermediate animal hosts in order to make it to humans. And for SARS, it was an animal called a civet. For MERS, it was the camel. It's not entirely clear what it is for SARS-CoV-2. It may be an animal called the pangolin. Oftentimes, these are domesticated animals that are the intermediate hosts. So pigs and ducks are involved with transmission to humans for influenza. And so this is a process that's occurring all the time. And most of the time, they're not pathogenic until they mutate and then can survive in humans. And most of them don't do very well in humans and don't cause much disease. But I'm just mentioning this for one major point. And there's no evidence that this virus is engineered. And there's every reason to think that this was just the process of the normal biology of these zoonoses making it into humans. And every once in a while, you get something as dire as one of these infections I've mentioned already, but this one has been particularly bad for some of the reasons that we understand. It was not that long ago when we wouldn't see these unusual infections in individuals and we wouldn't know, particularly pneumonias, and we would never be able to pin down what the source was. Now we have so many molecular tools at our disposal that we can pretty quickly identify the source for many of these infections. So this is not the last pandemic. And as I think probably most people know, influenza, avian influenza, and influenza more generally is the pandemic that most infectious disease epidemiologists would have predicted would be next. We're overdue for an influenza pandemic.
I'd like to move on to modeling and forecasting. We've heard about these different models that have been used to make these projections about how the disease will spread and how communities will be affected. Can you explain a bit about these different models, how people are coming up with these, and why there's such variation between the projections that they come out with?
Sure. When we think about forecasting the future, it's difficult for everything, including trying to track the outcome of this particular pandemic. In this particular case, modelers are relying on two broad approaches. The traditional epidemiological approach is to build something called a SEER model, susceptible, infected, recovered, and you rely on what we understand about the biology of the disease, what its incubation period might be, how long people remain infective, how fast the recovery occurs. And you then try to follow individuals through each of the steps of your particular model as they progress through the stages of the illness. And then you essentially account people in different stages at different points of time, and you use that to build projections into the future. These type of models are very robust. And one of the really advantageous things about them is you can ask what if scenarios. And so you can ask the model, well, if we remove social distancing restrictions, given what we know about the disease, what might happen? And you can build those into the forecast and provide information to policymakers that might be relevant. Of course, there are two major challenges to these types of models. One is much of the information that we want to know may not be available to us. We may not know with a high degree of precision what the incubation period is or how much of the spread is due to pre-symptomatic spread. And so modelers have to guess. And that leads to the second problem, which is if two different modelers choose two different guesses, then your model is going to have two different outcomes. And so these type of models are very susceptible to influence or bias on the perspective of the modeler. But nonetheless, they can be very robust and serve useful purposes. The other major approach is to take the data that you have, for example, the number of deaths that you've witnessed in a population, and make some type of assumption about what type of relationship you might expect to happen in the future, given the problem you're modeling. And so in this particular outbreak, many of the modelers are choosing a curve that is called a sigmoidal curve, where it has a very fast upslope towards exponential growth during the early phase of an infection. And then as we either reach herd immunity or we intervene by social distancing, that curve will flatten out and the number of cases will decline. And so that's basically a statistical or a mathematical approach. It too is a very reasonable stratagem. It relies though on the quality of the data that you have to input, and it also is very susceptible to the type of curve you've chosen to fit. And so if you've chosen a curve that doesn't really fit with the underlying biologic processes, you will produce data that's very useful and informative. And so these are the two broad approaches. There are models using either of these and they're publicly available. And so that explains some of the difference between them. And so probably for viewers, the best approach is to not look at just one model and pick a winner, but rather look at the different models and think about why that might be leading to disparate answers and which one may be more useful in the moment to answer the questions that you have.
So I know last week in the news, the Arizona Department of Health Services had kind of said, hey, you know, we're going to start using these models from the federal government. And then they kind of took that back and are now going back to incorporating the models from professors at Arizona State University and the University of Arizona. Can you tell us a little bit about the differences between these two types of models and if there's an advantage over one over the other or why they would both be considered?
Yeah, it's been an interesting time the last 2 weeks in our collaboration between Arizona State University, the University of Arizona, and the Arizona Department of Health Sciences. Our respective groups have been working with ADHS for a month now, maybe 6 weeks, and we, you know, kind of received this pause order to stop our work on these types of models. And one of the explanations was that the executive branch was considering models that are provided by FEMA. I can say that I haven't seen the FEMA model, so I can't provide comment one way or the other. You know, I have seen the model that the ASU group has produced. It's one of the epidemiologic models, so it's a SEER-based model, and it seems to be performing reasonably well, and it also has produced some really interesting data on what-if scenarios. Our group has now been reinstated. The collaboration is back on. But I think my advice to the executive branch or policymakers in Arizona would be not to rely on one particular model, but to try to put together different pieces of the puzzle from different sources and try to develop a composite picture that may be more reasonable than relying on just one particular source.
What are most of the models trying to answer? Are they trying to answer peak positive or other answers? Like what goes into the what they're trying to answer?
I think they're really trying to go after two questions. One is the trajectory or the pace of viral transmission to give us an understanding whether conditions are improving or getting worse, and so that we can decide whether to ratchet up or ratchet down our interventions. And I think the other important piece that they're trying to understand is what's the magnitude of the problem? How likely is it that our health capacity might be exceeded and lead to unnecessary deaths because the right treatments weren't available to the right people at the right time? And so those are probably the two most pressing issues that modelers are trying to address in the moment. But, you know, there also is a longer term picture here, thinking about, well, what's the fall going to look like? What might happen if SARS-CoV-2 becomes endemic? And is it going to become something like a seasonal influenza or other seasonal coronavirus infection where we have to manage peaks and valleys for the foreseeable future? That's considerably harder to do, but that's another question that's important to think about.
Now, let me ask a question that is coming from somebody who hasn't paid as much attention to modeling as perhaps I should have, but also doesn't know very much about it. I was looking at data from the University of Washington model, just because I happen to have a link there, and saw the projection for the peak date in Arizona change a lot over a fairly short period of time, going from initially from April 27th back to April 22nd, then to May 7th. And I was surprised that it could change that much over a short period of time. And my sort of intuition was that there must be some components of the model that are very sensitive to some particular input that change these peak times. But again, that's a very sort of simplistic view of it.
So yes, I would agree. The University of Washington model, which is the IHME model, is one that's a mathematical model. It's based on an assumption that the data are going to fit a specific curve. And so I think they've been criticized for a number of things. The two most prominent is one, they originally built their model based on the experience in China and then later in Italy, and made the assumption that the outbreak in the United States was going to follow a similar course as it had in these other countries, and that may not have been a valid assumption. And then the second is they've chosen a very specific curve to fit their model, and that curve has a very steep upslope, and because of that, it has a very deep downslope. And so I think it actually did quite well early on in predicting the pace of new infections and deaths early when we were rising and transmission was very rapid. But once we intervened and cases slowed, the particular curve that this group has used to fit really wants to pull the tail of that curve down and show a quick resolution of cases once an effective intervention has been implemented, much like it predicts a very steep upslope before anything is done at all. And this is kind of a shoulder problem. And what we've seen is that the curve for this outbreak is very asymmetric. It has a steep upslope and a very a slow downslope. And so I think that's where the IHME model has run into trouble. And they're continuing to revise that, but I think that was plaguing their earlier work.
Let me just sort of, that prompts me to ask you about the data that came from New York maybe 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks, saying that they surveyed, I think it was 3,000 people, and found 20% of them were positive. And you know, so that sort of fits with my intuition that we're underrepresenting the number of cases by an order of magnitude or more. But I mean, what do you think about that?
I agree. I think the New York data was very interesting and was it was consistent with my intuitive notion, which others had, which was it was really bad in New York, right? We probably didn't need that particular number to tell us that there had been a considerable amount of transmission. You know, I think what is most valuable in that number is we really need these kind of population-based prevalence estimates to understand where individual geographies lie on this continuum, because the experience in New York is very different from the experience that we've had here in Arizona, right? There's really no plausible way to think that prevalence in Arizona would come anywhere close to that. We're seeing some hints at that with the testing blitz of serology that just started in Arizona about a week or 10 days ago. And so the early numbers coming out of the Arizona serology data are around 3.5 to 4% of patients are testing positive for antibodies. The problem with what's kind of going on in Arizona is a similar problem that Santa Clara County experienced when they published their results online. Our sample is not necessarily a representative sample, and we still don't fully understand the test characteristics of this serology. Before this conversation, we were talking about sensitivity and specificity. And so false positives are a concern, particularly in a low prevalence state like ours. Missing a lot of cases could be problematic as well. And so when I look at Arizona's numbers between 3.5 and 4%, I think that represents the uppermost it could possibly be. My own particular hunch is that we're probably in the 2%, 2.5% range right now, if you match it up with deaths and things of that nature. But these types of studies are desperately needed in many, many locations around the country so that we can understand where each of us are.
So I'd like to jump back a little bit, Dr. Gerald. You were talking about, you know, another wave coming in the fall, and in the news a lot lately, we've been seeing how hospitals and health clinics are actually having this loss of revenue with all the cancellings and rescheduled elective screenings and surgeries and even regular well visits. What else is contributing to that loss of revenue at hospitals and health clinics?
Dr. Joyner may be better positioned to answer this than I am, but my impression is it's mostly attributable to the bottom falling out of elective procedures, elective surgeries, elective visits. And so people are only showing up at healthcare facilities when they absolutely have to be there. And prior to just past week, we've not allowed our healthcare providers to do these elective procedures. Dr. Joyner, am I missing something? Are there other pieces?
I think that is the essence of it. I mean, for most hospitals, and particularly for some of the larger ones, surgeries and elective surgeries are really the primary driver of the profit margin. The primary care side of, and I'll use primary care sort of in a very general sense, of hospital business is not particularly lucrative. So hospitals depend upon procedures and particularly elective procedures for a lot of their revenue. So when they not only were not allowed to carry out these elective surgeries, but also had to transition a lot of their beds to ICU type beds or take other beds out of service, it was a drastic hit to the revenue stream. And I think that will recover. I think the sort of timing of that and what's going to happen in the context of the loss of insurance by so many people is going to have an impact on how fast that recovers and what the nature of the recovery is. I can sort of just elaborate a little bit about it. There's more than 30 million people have applied for unemployment benefits. And so somewhere in the 20 to 27 million range have lost their employer-sponsored insurance. Not only have they not had the access that they might have had in the past for primary care services, but they, going forward, may not have any insurance at all. The only options for most of these people are either Medicaid or the healthcare exchanges through the Affordable Care Act. And it remains to be seen to what extent those two insurance products can fill in the gaps. And if people go without insurance, it's not very likely that they're going to be having these elective surgeries. And in fact, more concerning is that they're going to skip a lot of more sort of necessary processes of preventive care and other things that will have an impact long-term on their health, as well as on the service providers.
And is one of those things that you anticipate being a surge in chronic disease-related things, people who have put off types of interventions or procedures because of this, and then suddenly after the green light is given, the healthcare system will see a surge in procedures related to non-COVID?
I think that's going to happen. I think there's going to be deterioration in many aspects of chronic diseases, which are now where we spend 80% of our healthcare dollars in the country. Diabetes is one that just sort of where we, which is the disease that we spend the most on, is one of the more obvious. And I think it's hard to know exactly how this is going to manifest, but there are going to be disconnects between supply and demand of services and also access to those services because of lack of insurance.
Yeah, you bring up a great point about how that's going to shift. Do you see this as being a permanent shift on the healthcare system because of this? Is insurance going to respond in a way that is likely to take these types of things into consideration, because it's hit us so hard right now, and it hasn't really been something that that we faced like this before? How is the medical industry going to respond?
Well, I think there will be some permanent impacts. From my perspective, it's going to be more driven by what happens in the private insurance market than in Medicare and Medicaid. There's been a declining percentage of individuals in this country that are covered by private insurance because it's been so expensive for the employers. And so there's been shifts in the way that private insurance plans are structured to the high deductible plans with health savings accounts, and employers are trying to minimize their costs as much as possible. And now, as they try to recover financially from this, it's going to be even more problematic for them to provide private insurance plans. And, you know, most large companies are self-insured, but to provide private insurance plans that are as generous, for lack of a better word, as those that have been the case beforehand. So that just in and of itself is going to affect hospital revenues, but it also may mean that it accelerates the decrease that's already been ongoing for decades in the percentage of people with insurance in this country who have employer-sponsored insurance. I think we're probably looking at if not Medicaid, on the insurance plans provided through the marketplaces, through the Affordable Care Act. And you know, I just have to say that I find it, I'll say ironic, which is charitable, that many of the opponents of the Affordable Care Act in the past are now pointing to the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion and the marketplaces as the solution for providing healthcare insurance for those who've lost it because they've become unemployed. So I suspect there's going to be a pretty substantial shift in that regard.
One of the really interesting things that has gotten swallowed and eaten by the COVID whale is healthcare reform more broadly, leading up to the presidential Democratic primary. If you remember, the huge controversy was this notion of Medicare for all and single payer systems versus more incremental reforms, a public option. And all of that has essentially disappeared in the midst of what is arguably a health crisis and what may turn out to be a health insurance crisis as we move into a fall in anticipation of a second larger wave. And so we could see the uninsured rate go from its historic lows of 10% upward to 15 to 20%, I think, if this job recovery doesn't occur. Our health system is simply not prepared to withstand that, on top of the economic disruption that's already occurred through the loss of elective care and things of that nature. And, you know, we've also really missed this piece of the presidential debate between what is presumed to be the Democratic nominee and, of course, President Trump. None of this is on anyone's minds right now. And to the extent that it reemerges as we come closer to the November election, knowing more about what the uninsured rate is, what the health consequences of COVID are, what the healthcare cost, how much it's turning out to be, I would welcome this conversation resurfacing now, because it means a lot to the survival of our healthcare workforce, our healthcare institutions, and also the health and well-being of many, many Americans.
I'll just mention, in addition to people losing insurance, rural hospitals have been under stress for a long time, and a lot of rural hospitals have closed, and this is just adding to it. They don't have any financial cushion. They're very dependent upon Medicare and Medicaid, and they don't have any cushion. And this is going to force even more rapid closure of rural hospitals, which then disadvantages people in the rural communities who tend to be older, of lower income. You know, in Arizona, I'll just mention the Native American population. They're getting really hammered by this. And the Indian Health Service funding which is not dependent upon sort of this, the amount of service provided, but on a sort of a direct allocation, is likely going to be severely compromised financially.
So how might the public health workforce be able to step up and maybe help those in rural areas or those that are unable to go to all of their continued appointments because of this COVID-19 scare? What steps can the public health workforce take to help those individuals?
Well, for me personally, I'm not very optimistic. It's not something the public health workforce is designed to do or funded to do. It's really aspects of the traditional healthcare system. And I think the public health workforce is going to be overwhelmed for the foreseeable future, just trying to manage the direct consequences of COVID-19. And so, we could argue about how much public health funding should be, but historically it's represented 5% or less of total national health spending. And our workforce and infrastructure is aging, it's creaking, it's under-resourced. And so I think we have our hands full simply managing the direct consequences of this COVID outbreak. And I'm not sure that we're going to be able to provide much assistance except around the margin and doing little things here and there. But I don't think we're the solution to this much, much bigger problem that faces rural Arizonans and rural Americans in general.
Yeah, I agree. I think recognizing that this has not necessarily been sort of the role of the public health workforce, it's going to be even more important than it has been in the past for individuals to be aware of the options of getting Medicaid or signing up for insurance through the marketplaces. And a large fraction of people who are eligible even before COVID-19 have not signed up. And a lot of this has to do with education to the extent that the public health workforce can facilitate people's understanding of what their options are, that may help some.
Just looking at the time, it's flown by, and I know that we could keep talking about this, but we want to respect your time. Is there anything, Dr. Gerald, Dr. Joyner, that you'd like to add?
No, not for me. I really thank you for inviting me to participate and to share some of my thoughts. This is an unprecedented time in our modern history, and we really don't have a good understanding how things are going to unfold. And so I've got my fingers crossed, but at the same time, I have a lot of worries that we may not be managing this in the most effective way possible. And so I worry what's going to happen when the fall comes and we might have to manage even more cases than we're struggling with now.
I agree. Thank you for involving me in this discussion. I am optimistic at one level that down the road, we're going to understand a lot better about the clinical aspects of the disease. But by the same token, it's difficult right now to sort through what's fact and what's fiction. I saw the other day that there's been 5,000 or something like that articles published on COVID-19 in the last 2 months. And a lot of them are not peer reviewed. And a lot of them are, I've been asked to review some articles and I've given, been given 3 days to do it. And then they show up and there's just a lot of material that's out there that may be correct, maybe not, but hopefully we can get to some better place on that down the road.
I agree. And as many people are sitting on the edge of their seat waiting for this information, I think the review process is often something that's left behind because people expect this information right now and they expect it to be accurate. But these things do take time. Right. And in order for policymakers to make decisions off of them and for people to make decisions for their family off of them, I think one of the things that we take for granted is information.
Right.
And so thank you again for your time and for all you guys do, and look forward to reading about your contributions in the future.
Thank you both for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.